From the right, he named Dearborns, for Henry Dearborn, the Secretary of War. He called it a handsome, bold, and clear stream. That morning, July 18th, he noted, "A large herd of the big-horned animals on the immensely high and nearly perpendicular cliff opposite to us. On the face of this cliff, they walked about and bounded from rock to rock with apparent unconcern, where it appeared to me that no quadruped could have stood, and from which, had they made one false step, they must have been precipitated at least 500 feet. Lewis's anxiety to meet the Shoshones increased. He talked with Clark. They agreed that one or the other of them would take a small party and proceed by land upriver to get well ahead of the canoes in order to find some Shoshones. Their idea was that the daily firing of the rifles by the hunters would frighten away the Shoshones, who would assume their enemy, the Blackfeet, were around. Of course, the land party would also have to fire weapons to sustain itself, but not so many of them. Clark led the party. It left at dawn on July 19th. Lewis led the canoes up the river. It was hard going, whether using the cord, the setting poles, or the paddles. Whenever the mountains broke back to give a view, there was to their right the disheartening sight of lofty summits all covered with snow, standing between the expedition and its goal. Meanwhile, Lewis noted unhappily, "We are almost suffocated in this confined valley with heat." That evening, "We entered much the most remarkable cliffs that we have yet seen. These cliffs rise from the water's edge on either side perpendicularly to the height of 1,200 feet. Every object here wears a dark and gloomy aspect. The towering and projecting rocks in many places seem ready to tumble on us. For the distance of 5¾ miles, the river is deep from side to side, nor is there, in the first 3 miles of this distance, a spot on which a man could rest the sole of his foot. It was late in the evening before I entered this place, obliged to continue my route until some time after dark before I found a place sufficiently large to encamp my small party. At length such a one occurred on the large side. From the singular appearance of this place, I called it the Gates of the Rocky Mountains." In the morning, as the flotilla paddled its way out of the canyon, the mountains receded and a beautiful intermountain valley presented itself. But about 10 o'clock a.m., a distressing, worry-making sight appeared in the sky. A column of smoke coming out of a creek drainage some 7 miles west, big enough to have been deliberately set. It had to have been done by Indians, all but certainly Shoshone, and almost surely because a single Indian or a small party had heard the discharge of a rifle and set fire to the grass to warn the rest of the tribe to retreat into the interior of the mountains. That was about as bad as anything that could happen, but there was nothing to do but press on. The following day, the flotilla entered a beautiful and extensive plain country of about 10 or 12 miles wide, which extended upwards further than the eye could reach. This valley is bounded by 2 nearly parallel ranges of high mountains, which have their summits partially covered with snow. Lewis was within a couple of hours' march from one of the great gold deposits at Last Chance Gulch in present Helena, Montana. But he wasn't looking for gold. His lack of interest in it was one of the things that distinguished his exploration from that of his Spanish predecessors. Another was his lack of interest in converting Indians to Christianity. Interested in plants and animals, especially fur-bearing animals, he paid little attention to potential mineral deposits, especially after leaving the Mandans. He had noted lead deposits on the lower Missouri, but when he entered the Rockies, he hardly ever commented on rocks or minerals. Why should he? In the pre-railroad age, there was no way to move heavy, bulky items, no matter how valuable, from the mountains back to the seaboard. In his final instructions to Lewis, Jefferson had ordered the explorer to take note of the mineral deposits, but he meant such minerals as lead, iron, and coal, valuable adjuncts to an agricultural economy, not export items. Donald Jackson comments that this unconcern with minerals was a blank spot in Lewis's thinking that he almost surely had acquired from Jefferson. The Rockies were too far away for mining, for any commerce but the fur trade, and so were not an object of study and speculation, but only a wretchedly cold obstacle between men and the sea. As far as Lewis and Jefferson were concerned, animals, not minerals, were the great wealth of the Rocky Mountains. 10 days after passing Last Chance Gulch, the expedition made camp on a small creek entering today's Beaverhead River. The captains named it Willard's Creek, in honor of Private Alexander Willard. Nothing remarkable happened, Donald Jackson writes. It would be 60 years before Willard's Creek was renamed Grasshopper Creek, and the Beaverhead country teemed with gold miners. Jackson speculates on what might have happened had the expedition brought back a handful of nuggets from Willard's Creek. Nomadic fur traders, blazing trails in the years immediately following Lewis and Clark, might have been joined by adventurous miners. The finding of shorter and easier trails, such as the route across South Pass in southern Wyoming, would have occurred earlier. The timetable for Western settlement would surely have been advanced by a generation, and that peculiar American invention, Indian removal, would have become standard government policy much earlier in the area west of the Mississippi. As the mountains began to close in again, toward evening on July 22nd, the expedition got a badly needed morale booster. The men were laboring mightily, often in the water pulling the canoes along, feet slipping or getting caught on rocks, the river apparently having no end, the mountains crowding in, the great buffalo herds now left behind on the plains, no whiskey left, the days beginning to grow noticeably shorter. Sacagawea recognized this section of the river. She had been here as a girl. It was the river on which the Shoshones lived in the summer. The Three Forks were at no great distance ahead. This piece of information has cheered the spirits of the party, Lewis duly noted. At 4 o'clock p.m., the flotilla reached Clark, who had made camp on the starboard side. He had found no Indians, although he had seen signs that they were out there. He had left some presents, cloth and linen, in order to inform the Indians, should they pursue his trail, that we were not their enemies, but white men and their friends. But the thing that stood out was Clark's physical condition, more specifically, his feet. They were a raw, bleeding mass of flesh, torn apart by prickly pears. "I opened the bruises and blisters of my feet, which caused them to be painful," Clark wrote in his own get-to-the-point fashion. He spent the day resting, waiting for Lewis to come up with the canoes. The captains talked. They agreed that another overland expedition was necessary. Clark wanted to lead it. He wanted another chance at finding Indians and overcoming prickly pears. One day of self-enforced idleness was all he could take. He itched to be back at work. Lewis wrote, "Although Captain C. was much fatigued, his feet yet blistered and sore, he insisted on pursuing his route in the morning, nor would he consent willingly to my relieving him. Finding him anxious, I readily consented to remain with the canoes." Clark told the Field brothers and Private Robert Frazier to get ready to accompany him in the morning. Charbonneau asked if he could go along. Clark agreed. This was about as close to a disagreement that the captains ever came, or at least ever wrote about, with regard to rank. In Lewis's version, "I readily consented." In Clark's version, "I determined to proceed on in pursuit of the Snake Indians." So insistent was Clark that he had determined, rather than Lewis's having consented, that years later, in editing the journals for publication, Clark had "I determined" substituted for Lewis's "he insisted." As a dispute, that wasn't much, more a disagreement over the right word to describe the decision-making process than a fight over the question of who was in command. For Virginians, taught rank consciousness from birth, sensitive to the slightest slight, concern about rank, status, and position was as much a part of life as breathing. Lewis's journal description of this little incident is written on an unspoken, probably unconscious, assumption that he could order Clark to stay with the canoes while he took the scouts to look for Indians. Clark disagreed. In his view, this was a case of "I determined" rather than "you allowed." There is a hint in the decision that the captains thought Clark was the better at approaching and dealing with Indians, but just a hint. The makeup of Clark's party is puzzling. Why did Charbonneau have to ask to come along, and why didn't Clark bring Sacagawea? The captains had brought her all this way so that she could be the contact person with the Shoshones. Instead, Clark was proposing to approach them with three other armed men, none of them proficient with the sign language. Driar was camped upriver a few miles that night. He had been hunting. the only Shoshone words Clark knew he had been taught by Sacagawea. He had asked her what was her people's word for white man. Tababone, she replied. Actually, the Shoshones had no word for white man, never having seen one. Scholars have guessed that Tababone might have meant stranger or enemy. Certainly, bringing along a recently ill young woman with a papoose on her back would have slowed the party. But then, how fast was Clark going to go with his feet in tatters? Anyway, proceeding slowly would have been preferable to blundering ahead, hoping to bump into some Indians, yet having no way to communicate with them. When it came his turn to lead an overland search for Shoshones, Lewis followed Clark's example and did not ask Sacagawea to accompany him. The captain shared a hubris that they could handle Indians. They believed they needed Sacagawea's interpreting ability only to trade for horses, not to establish contact. And they had no ability whatsoever to see the initial encounter from the Shoshone's point of view. Four-man parties, armed better even than the Blackfeet, approaching on foot, shouting something that sounded like stranger or enemy. Did Clark really expect these Indians to come running to embrace him when they saw the American flag? In this case, it would seem that the captains allowed their self-confidence and perhaps their male chauvinism to override their common sense. Clark set out the next morning, July 23rd, in search of Indians. Lewis headed upriver. Conditions were awful. Our trio of pests still invade and obstruct us on all occasions. These are the mosquitoes, eye gnats, and prickly pears. It was hot. Progress was measured in yards, even feet. The men complain of being much fatigued. Their labor is excessively great. So moved was Lewis by their effort, and so eager was he to get on, that I occasionally encourage them by assisting in the labor of navigating the canoes, and have learned to push a tolerable good pole, in their phrase. He still had time for observation. Signs of beaver were noted, and otter. Cranes, geese, red-breasted mergansers, and curlews brought comment. He saw a great number of snakes, killed one, examined its teeth to see if they were hollow and thus would carry poison, and found them innocent. What excited wonder also caused worry. The mountains, they still continue high and seem to rise in some places like an amphitheater, one range above another, as they recede from the river until the most distant and lofty have their tops clad with snow. They loomed out there every time Lewis looked to his right, waiting for him. Another frustration. The river was now flowing from a southeasterly direction, so progress was taking the expedition in exactly the wrong direction. Another worry. Although Sacagawea insisted that there were no falls or obstructions in the river above, Lewis confessed, I can scarcely form an idea of a river running to great extent through such a rough, mountainous country without having its stream intercepted by some difficult and dangerous rapids or falls. Another pest. Needle grass, an invention of the devil, consisting of barbed seeds which penetrate our moccasins and leather leggings and give us great pain until they are removed. My poor dog suffers with them excessively. He is constantly biting and scratching himself as if in a rack of pain. Another day on the river, making about 18 miles per day. Endless. Exhausting. July 27th. We set out at an early hour and proceeded on, but slowly. The current still so rapid that the men are in a continual state of their utmost exertion to get on, and they begin to weaken fast from this continual state of violent exertion. They had reached the breaking point. Then fortune smiled. Just around the turn, at 9 o'clock a.m., Lewis in the lead canoe came to a junction with the river from the southeast. A quarter mile or so upstream, two rivers came together, a southwest fork and a middle fork, making the Three Forks. As Lewis described it, the country opened suddenly to extensive and beautiful plains and meadows, which appear to be surrounded in every direction with distant and lofty mountains. He came to shore on the larboard side. Telling the men to rest, he set out to climb a nearby high limestone cliff. At the top, I commanded a most perfect view of the neighboring country. Looking up the southeast fork, he saw smooth, extensive green meadow of fine grass. A distant range of lofty mountains rose their snow-clad tops above the irregular and broken mountains which lie adjacent to this beautiful spot. From the cliff Lewis stood on, the view today is still spectacular. There are modern intrusions, Interstate Highway 90, Montana Highway 287, and a few secondary roads run through it, and the little town of Three Forks is a few miles away, but the overall scene is as it was. There is a tremendous bowl containing the linked valleys of the two rivers coming out of today's Yellowstone Park to the south and east, and the valley of the river to the southwest, coming down from the Madisons. The rivers are crowded with fish and waterfowl. The banks are crowded with deer. The mountains surround the bowl in a nearly complete circle of up to 100 miles in diameter and are just as Lewis saw them, lofty and snow-covered. After writing a description of the Three Forks area, Lewis returned to the canoes, ate breakfast, and led the flotilla upstream. At the junction of the Middle and the Southwest Forks, he found a note Clark had written and stuck on a pole. It said he would rejoin Lewis here unless he fell in with some fresh sign of Indians, in which case he intended to follow the Indians and would count on Lewis to ascend the southwest or right-hand fork. Lewis immediately agreed with Clark's judgment that the right-hand was the fork to take. He set up camp and made plans to stay a while because, believing this to be an essential point in the geography of this western part of the continent, I determined to remain at all events until I obtained the necessary data for fixing its latitude, longitude, etc. And it wouldn't hurt to give the men a chance to rest. Lewis set out to explore. Comparing the Middle Fork with the Southwest Fork, he could see no difference in character or size. Therefore, to call either of these streams the Missouri would be giving it a preference which its size does not warrant, as it is not larger than the other. They are each 90 yards wide. Lewis named the Southeast Fork Gallatin's River, in honor of Albert Gallatin, Secretary of the Treasury. The Middle Fork he called Madison's River, in honor of James Madison, Secretary of State. The Southwest Fork, the one he intended to follow, he called Jefferson's River, in honor of that illustrious personage Thomas Jefferson, President of the United States. At 3 o'clock p.m., Captain Clark came into camp. He was extremely sick, completely exhausted. He told Lewis he had been sick all night, with a high fever, frequent chills, and constant pains in his muscles. Nevertheless, in the morning, he had made a forced march of about 8 miles up the Middle Fork, but finding no Indian sign, decided to return to Three Forks. He said he was somewhat bilious and had not had a passage for several days. Lewis convinced Clark that a dozen of Rush's pills would be sovereign in this case. He said it always worked. Clark agreed to take 5. Lewis also convinced Clark to bathe his feet in warm water. Despite the treatment, Clark closed his short journal entry for the day. I continue to be very unwell, fever very high. Lewis closed his journal that night with a worry. We begin to feel considerable anxiety with respect to the Snake Indians, he wrote. If we do not find them, I fear the successful issue of our voyage will be very doubtful, or at all events much more difficult in its accomplishment. He believed the expedition would soon reach the bosom of this wild and mountainous country, and realized that meant game would grow scarce, perhaps even non-existent. Meanwhile, the expedition would be without any information with respect to the country, not knowing how far these mountains continue, or where to direct our course to pass them to advantage, or intercept a navigable branch of the Columbia. Without Shoshone horses, without Shoshone information, the expedition might as well turn around and go home, or so Lewis feared, although he was prepared to press on as long as it was possible. He consoled himself with the thought that the Jefferson River had to head with the tributaries of the Columbia. As to the lack of game, he figured that if any Indians can subsist in the form of a nation in these mountains with the means they have of acquiring food, we can also subsist. The expedition spent 2 days at the Three Forks, the men making clothing or hunting, Lewis making celestial observations, Clark recuperating. Always the booster and developer, Lewis proposed the establishment of a fort at Three Forks, at the far western limit of Louisiana, where the rivers and creeks teemed with beaver. that it was almost 3,000 miles up the Missouri from St. Louis and the nearest civilization bothered him not a bit. There was plenty of timber, and the grass is luxuriant and would afford a fine swath of hay. Sacajawea informed him that the expedition's camp was precisely on the spot where the Shoshones had been camped 5 years ago, when a raiding party of Hidatsas discovered them. The Shoshones had retreated 3 miles upriver and hidden in a wood. But the Hidatsas had found and routed them, killing 4 men, 4 women, and a number of boys, and making prisoners of 4 boys and all the remaining women, including Sacajawea. I cannot discover that she shows any imitation of sorrow in recollecting this event, Lewis concluded his journal entry relating Sacajawea's story, or of joy in being again restored to her native country. If she has enough to eat and a few trinkets to wear, I believe she would be perfectly content anywhere. One wonders if Lewis was comparing Sacajawea with the young black female slaves he had known, or with white women of his own class. One wonders, too, how the man who could be so observant about so many things, including the feelings and point of view of his men, could be so unobservant about Sacajawea's situation. A slave, one of only 2 in the party, she was also the only Indian, the only mother, the only woman, the only teenaged person. Small wonder she kept such a tight grip on her emotions. Captain Clark had improved somewhat. Though his fever was gone, he was still very languid and complains of a general soreness in all his limbs. Lewis prescribed Peruvian bark for the tonic effect of its quinine. Over the next week, Lewis, with Driard and small parties of men, and once Sacajawea,